Welcome to Torah Imecha Parsha with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Leah Feinberg, and today we will be learning Parashat Vayeshev. At the outset of our parasha, we find that Yaakov Avinu has settled in the land of his fathers with the apparent intention of living out his remaining years in peace and tranquility, following his tumultuous years running from his brother Esav and remaining alert to the manipulations of his uncle and father-in-law, Lavan. Unfortunately, Yaakov's vision of his golden age was not to be realized. The sibling rivalry among his sons would lead to devastating events and new challenges to Yaakov's serenity. Yosef is now 17 years old and a shepherd along with his brothers. Yaakov favored Yosef among his brothers, for he was his ben zikunim, a phrase that has given rise to many explanations. Rashi alone offers three suggestions, the first of which is the most literal. Ben Zikunim, the son of his old age. He then cites Unculus, the Aramaic translation, who translates as Bar Hakim Hule, for he was a wise son. The term Zakein in the Torah often means Chacham, wise. And Yaakov transmitted to Yosef the Torah that he had learned from Shem and Aver. Rashi's third explanation is based on reading the term Ben Zikunim as a hint to the phrase Ziv Ikunin, meaning his countenance. Of all the sons, Yosef most closely resembled his father. Ramban, noting the term Lo at the end of the phrase Ben Zikunim Hu Lo, for he was a Ben Zikunim exclusively to his father, suggests that it was the practice of elderly fathers to designate a younger son to serve them in their old age, and it was this role fulfilled by Yosef, which endeared him especially to his father and made him the perfect candidate for receiving his father's Mesorah. Kliyakar suggests that perhaps the modifier lo indicates that Yosef expressed to his father a desire to learn more. Whereas the other brothers were happy to run out the door at the end of a lesson, Yosef stayed behind to ask questions and press for further insight, and thus he became the beneficiary of the additional learning that Yaakov had gained in the yeshiva of Shem and Aver. The Kliyakar also suggests another suggestion for the modifier. Only in his behavior with Yaakov was Yosef's superior maturity in evidence. When he was with his brothers, he behaved childishly, and when he was with his father, he behaved like a mature scholar. Kezaken v'ragil upirko na'eh. And therefore, Yaakov favored him. He saw only his superiority in ruchniyut, in spirituality, and not the shallow vanity that was in evidence only when he was with his brothers, alongside whom he is described as a na'ar, a youth who engaged in more typically adolescent behavior. According to the Kliyakar, this demonstrates Yosef's wisdom in knowing what behavior is expected and acceptable in which circumstances. As an expression of his special love for Yosef, Yaakov made for him a striped or checkered garment, iktonet pasim. The pasuk expresses that this garment, as a visible sign of Yaakov's favoritism, caused the brothers to hate him so intensely that they couldn't even speak to him civilly. Chazal actually view this in a positive light. The brothers were men of such personal integrity that they were incapable of feigning love or even tolerance for Yosef when, in fact, they hated him. At the very least, they were incapable of hypocrisy. Why did Yaakov make this garment for Yosef in the first place? And how could he not have anticipated that there would be repercussions? Moreover, why did the Ketonet Pasim trigger such jealousy among the brothers? We're not talking about preschoolers here. We're talking about grown men who are all characterized by Chazal as tzadikim gemurim, completely righteous, who sold their brother into slavery over a coat. Dat Sofrim explains that Yaakov by nature is an ish emet. He expects his children to recognize the same objective truth that he sees. He fully expects each of the siblings to recognize the qualities of the others without jealousy. This is a moral precept that he has instilled in them since the beginning of the story. As an ish emet, Yaakov recognizes the moral superiority of Yosef, and he expects his children to admire him for his moral stature. That was the educative purpose of the Ketonet Pasim. But this is a very tall order. Human beings tend to be subjective. And as we have suggested, the circumstances in which the brothers saw Yosef were not identical to those in which Yaakov saw him. And then, to complicate matters even further, Yosef dreamed two dreams that reflected his superiority and domination over his brothers, one in which he and his brothers were gathering wheat in the field, and the brothers' bundles of wheat surrounded Yosef's bundle and bowed to it, and the second in which the sun, moon, and 11 stars, which are interpreted to reflect Yaakov, his wife, and the 11 brothers, bowed to Yosef himself. The moon representing Yaakov's wife could not have been Rachel because she was no longer alive at this time. So Chazal explained that it represented Bilhah, who had sort of taken Rachel's place as Yosef's foster mother. And the moon reflected her submission to Yosef. Abarbanel explains the scenario as follows. Yosef, whose brothers hate him for their perception of the role that he plays in their father's estimation, Yosef himself is innocent of hatred and not only harbors no ill feeling towards his brothers, but he tries to win them over. That's why he shares his dreams with them in the manner of a shared confidence with a trusted ally. He tells them his dreams in the hope that they will recognize his sincerity and see that their father singling him out is not mere favoritism. Rather, it's a sign that he's been chosen by Hashem for a special mission. Da'at Sofrim suggests that since the dream was in fact a prophecy, Yosef was compelled to share it, as prophecy can't be suppressed. The brothers felt that Yosef was either fabricating the dreams entirely, or that they reflected his hidden ambition to usurp them as Yaakov's spiritual heirs. This is key to understanding the story. It's important to remember that in the previous two generations, only one son was chosen to carry on his father's legacy. The others were sent away. So Yaakov was chosen over Esav, and Yitzchak had been chosen over Yishmael and the sons of Keturah. So the brothers thought that Yosef was angling for a similar position as the spiritual heir of their father, which would be to their detriment. And no less important, based on his behavior among them in the field, they considered him to be an unworthy candidate for such an important position. It's possible that had they seen him as Yaakov saw him, they would not have acted the way that they did. Against this backdrop of hatred and jealousy, Yaakov sent Yosef to check on his brothers and bring back word of their welfare. Yosef went from Hebron to Shechem, but he did not immediately find his brothers. A man found him wandering in the field and asked him what he was looking for. And when Yosef responded that he was looking for his brothers, the man told him that he had overheard the brothers expressing their intention to go to Dothan. So Yosef followed their path and he found them in Dothan. Who is this unidentified man who is so pivotal to the story and yet remains unnamed? Nechama Leibovitz, Zichrona Livracha, in a moving passage, sensitizes us to the pathos of this moment. This brief conversation occurs between two worlds, between the tranquil and sheltered life of Yosef in his father's house, where he basks in his father's love and attention, and between the shattered world of suffering and travail which is about to ensue after he encounters his brothers. Many commentators have been baffled by this conversation, for it is highly unusual for the Torah to include marginal characters and record their every word. Therefore, Chazal see in this mysterious, all-knowing stranger who appears out of nowhere, not a simple passerby, but an angel sent to direct not only Yosef himself, but the entire course of Jewish history. And here, again, is the key to understanding the whole story of Yosef and his brothers. Everything that's happening is happening on two levels. On the one hand, if we were to ask any of the protagonists in the story to explain why they're doing what they're doing, they would have a perfectly plausible set of motives and explanations for their behavior. Yet we, with the benefit of hindsight, can see that there is a much deeper plan in place here, and a prime mover who is conducting events with the precision of a virtuoso. Rav Soloveitchik describes this approach as, quote, the sheer impact of Jewish destiny and the inexorable dynamic of historical realization of the Jewish people, end quote, which compels all the actors in this drama to act in the way in which Hashem had planned, rather than according to reason. The brothers, upon seeing Yosef approaching them from a distance, assumed that he was coming to tell them yet another dream or lord over them in some way. They began plotting to kill him and throw his body into a pit, when Reuven suggested that they not actually spill his blood, merely throw him into the pit. The Pasuk informs us that his intention was to return and save him once the brothers had moved on. When Yosef reached his brothers, they divested him of his tunic and threw him into the pit, which is described as empty and free of water. And Rashi notes that if the pit was empty, obviously it contained no water, and cites the teaching of Chazal that the pit was empty only of water, but did contain snakes and scorpions. Later commentators suggest that this may have been a test of the righteousness of Yosef. If he were truly righteous, then he would be unharmed. But if he were deserving of punishment, then nature would take its course. The brothers, having thrown Yosef into the pit and leaving him to his destiny, then sat down to eat. And Sfarno explains that while we might be astonished at the complacency which allowed the brothers to enjoy a picnic lunch after leaving their brother to languish in a pit, this testifies to the fact that they, as 10 righteous men, had acted as a Beit Din and condemned Yosef for plotting to eliminate them from Yaakov's legacy. And as such, they deemed him a Rodef, one who was pursuing them with intent to harm, and thus they were halachically obligated to act in self-defense. At this point, a caravan of Ishmaelite merchants approached, and Yehuda suggested that rather than leaving Yosef to die, they sell him for a profit. Midianite merchants passed as well, and Yosef was pulled from the pit and sold multiple times before he was ultimately brought to Mitzrayim. Reuven, who was apparently not present when Yosef was sold, Rashi cites the teaching of Chazal that he was engaged in teshuva, in penitence, for having moved his father's bed, now returned to the pit to save him, and he found that he was gone. And when he returned to his brothers and expressed his distress, they dipped Yosef's tunic, which they had taken from him, into the blood of a goat that they had killed for the purpose, and sent the garment to Yaakov, saying, "Do you recognize this? Is this the tunic of your son?" And Yaakov drew the conclusion that Yosef had been attacked by a wild animal who had devoured him. Yaakov was inconsolable over the loss of his son. And meanwhile, Yosef was sold to Potiphar, the Sar HaTabachim of Paro, which is translated either as the chief slaughterer of all the meat in Paro's kitchen, or the chief executioner of Paro. At this point, the narrative of Yosef and his brothers is interrupted by the account of Yehuda and Tamar, which culminates in the birth of twin sons, Peretz and Zerach, from whom Malchut Beit David and ultimately the Melech HaMashiach will descend. The Midrash teaches, each of the personalities highlighted in the narrative was busy with his own personal situation, with the short-sightedness of the human condition, while Hashem, in his omniscience, orchestrated the long-term historical ramifications of their actions. Each was trying to ascertain his own continuity. The Shvatim sold Yosef because of the perceived threat that he posed. Yosef was busy with his mourning. It seems that Yosef felt that he had been rejected from the family and from his father's legacy, and he didn't know that his father didn't know what had happened to him. So he was mourning his own loss. Reuven was busy trying to redeem himself so that he might be reinstated to his position within the family. Yaakov was mourning for the son in whom he had invested as his spiritual heir. Yehuda was busy trying to establish his own legacy by building a family. And all of these efforts played a role in the ultimate plan, the birth of Mashiach, and in the final redemption. At the end of Parashat Vayeshev, Yosef finds himself in prison after having refused the advances of his master's wife, who then accused him of trying to rape her. While in prison, he successfully interpreted the dreams of the king's baker and butler and asked the butler to remember him to Paro when he is reinstated to his position as foretold in the dream. Chazal criticized Yosef for this request, saying that he should have relied solely on Hashem, that the memory of his own dreams should have sufficed to assure him of his own imminent salvation. However, Ralbag praises Yosef for his request of the butler and frames it as hishtadlut, necessary human effort, to avoid relying on a miracle. The debate as to where the line falls between miraculous, divine providence, Hashgachat Hashem, and the need for human effort continues even today. It's a very fine line. Rav Hanach Leibowitz, Zatzal of Yeshivat Chafetz Chaim, explains Yosef's conundrum, addressing why he was punished with 2 additional years in jail for relying on the Sar HaMashkim. Certainly on a cognitive level, Yosef believed without a shadow of a doubt that everything that had happened to him was decreed by Hashem and that ultimately he would be redeemed and the prophecies of his dreams would be fulfilled. Nevertheless, emotionally, in the depths of his heart, there were fleeting, ephemeral moments in which he experienced fear. This approach allows us a fascinating glimpse into the psyche of Yosef, his complete righteousness notwithstanding. He must have had moments in which he knew cognitively that his redemption would somehow come about and his dreams would be realized, but emotionally it somehow seemed as though he had been abandoned by everyone in whom he had placed his trust, and that impacted his emunah, even in the most fine way. We today can certainly relate to Yosef as he faced this challenge to his bitachon, and we can be inspired by the paradigm of redemption that he represents. May we soon merit to see openly the divine hand that continues to guide us through history.